Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Rebecca Sipes to talk to her about her forthcoming book, Women in Musical Salons and the Enlightenment, out May 2022 with the University of Chicago Press. Dr. Sipes is a musicologist, an historical keyboardist, and the Associate Dean of Academic Affairs at the Mason Gross School of Arts at Rutgers University. Hello, Rebecca, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful. So how are you today? Is it spring in New Jersey?
It is spring, but it's sort of a cold and rainy day today. So looking forward to warmer weather soon.
It's on its way. All right. Okay, before we go any further, I need some explanation on what it means to be an historical keyboardist.
Okay, yes. So I'm a performer. I've trained on keyboard instruments that were used in the 17th and 18th centuries primarily. And I use these in my research. So in thinking about the experience, for example, of women and musical salons in the 18th century, I want to try to understand their experience from an insider perspective as much as possible. And one of the ways that I have done that is by using, you know, historical keyboards, including harpsichords and early pianos, sort of the grandfathers or grandmothers, if you will, of the modern piano, the kind of Steinway piano that most people are used to seeing in concert halls today, to think about the kinds of performance practices that they used, their approach to music, how these instruments foster the sense of sociability that was so important in salons in the 18th century. So in thinking through some of the practical problems, issues, things that you need to work around when dealing with historical instruments, I think I've been able to get a kind of interesting new perspective on the ways that these women fostered musical sociability.
So you feel that like your work as a performer really feeds into your work as a musicologist, and there's a dialectic there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I see performance as one of the tools, certainly not the only tool that I can use to get at the past as a musicologist.
And do you play with an ensemble? Yes.
Yes, I'm very fortunate to have some really fabulous collaborators here in the sort of New York to Philadelphia area. Mm-hmm. And I started working with them on musical salon practices back in 2014, when I was first sort of encountering and thinking about music in the salon of the Jewish Berlin-based salon hostess, Sarah Levy. So with a group of very, you know, open-minded and interesting and eager collaborators, I put together a program of music from her salon. And we later recorded that and had to think of a name for our group. So we called ourselves the Raritan Players after the river that runs by New Brunswick, New Jersey, in the historic Raritan Valley here.
Wonderful. All right. So in these instruments, are they widely available? Or, I mean, is there something you've had to work on? How did you come upon like historical instruments?
Right. Some of both. So for this book, actually, there's a companion website that includes audio examples for people who don't read music score or can't look at a music score and sort of hear the music in their head, which I think is quite common. We've included on a companion website hosted by the University of Chicago Press. I've created a website with audio examples that accompany each of the kind of score examples that appear in the book. So for those audio examples, and indeed for a set of recordings that I've produced with this group and issued separately, you know, on the ACES label, I've used a set of historical instruments, including a large double manual harpsichord, two keyboard harpsichord, a Viennese style forte piano, a sort of early piano of the sort that Mozart, for example, would have known. And in addition, I've been very, very fortunate to have access to an original 1780 square piano built. I know it's miraculous. An original piano built in London by essentially the most popular and innovative keyboard builder in London at the time. He was a German immigrant named Johannes Zumpe, or Zumpe, as he came to be known, Z-U-M-P-E. And this instrument was restored in the 1990s by an instrument builder named Tim Hamilton here in the United States. And it's on loan to me from a person named Leslie Martin, who's been very, very generous in allowing me to sort of babysit this instrument and use it for my projects. So actually, I write about that instrument in particular rather extensively in the book, because it is a very unusual instrument to have in good playing condition. I think from as early as 1780, there are really a very, very small number of instruments of that sort that are still usable and useful in performance. So the experience of playing that instrument is really quite different from that larger early piano of the sort that Mozart and the Viennese would have known. This is an instrument, the square piano, it was popular in London and in Paris, which were the kind of glittering musical scenes in Europe. At that point, Vienna was in many ways still kind of a backwater, imitating other musical centers like Naples. So these square pianos were brought, they became very popular in London and in Paris, including in salons. And some of the salon hostesses and performers whom I write about in the book, and composers, women composers whom I write about in the book, advocated for the use of these square pianos as early as the 1760s, so long before they became very widespread. So these women were really forward thinking in adopting this instrument.
That is fascinating. And I really think it's interesting. I think our listeners should appreciate what kind of very unique perspective you're able to bring on this into this work. That's fascinating. It also just sounds really cool. I'm guessing that I'm guessing this is like something you just fully geek out on too, and just absolutely love doing this.
Absolutely. What that instrument does, I'll just wax rhapsodic about it for another minute. What that instrument does is it really opens a whole sound world that is just not available on other types of keyboard instruments, and especially I think on the modern piano. You know, the modern piano is really built for large concert halls. It was made to be loud and powerful, and you know, the sound needed to be able to cut through an orchestra of very large proportions. And these square pianos, you know, they can have a very big sound, and they can kind of accommodate a really muscular technique. But in addition, they also have the capacity to sound like a harp, or to sound even like the Aeolian harp, right? That kind of mythic, folk-like instrument that seems to emerge from nature. That was the theory about it anyway, that it sort of was this completely natural instrument. Of course, the technology was actually quite advanced. So there's this really interesting tension between the natural or the pastoral and this, you know, advanced technology, which is also something that I discuss in the book. But, you know, for example, the songs of one of the salon hostesses that I write about, she was a composer and a keyboardist named Madame Brion, Anne-Louise Brion. So she wrote these songs that are very little known today, but that she would have played in her salon together with her daughters who could play keyboard instruments and also sing. And in these songs, she writes these really lush, you know, arpeggiated figures that just sound like a harp. And using this instrument, you really get that sense in a way that you just can't get on other types of instruments. There are these pedals that make the sound just all washed together, almost like a watercolor painting. And it's just a beautiful, I think, a beautiful sound that is really, really unique.
Wow, that's great. So before we get right into Madame Brion, so your previous publications, I'm looking at Sarah Levy's World, Gender, Judaism, and the Baroque Tradition and Enlightenment Berlin, that's Rochester Press 2018, and Curious in Modern Inventions, Instrumental Music is Discovering Gallows, Italy, Chicago 2016, show this like long-standing interest in music, like science and enlightenment, how these things go together, and gender. So I'm seeing the precedence for this current work. What am I not seeing? Tell me how it is exactly you came to this. What made you enter this book?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, you're right that all these pieces of work sort of they emerged just from my own sense of curiosity. Like I want to pursue topics as far as I can, at the same time the Galileo project, right, is about a very, very different period, a very different kind of musical repertoire and set of performance practices. But although, right, it still is sort of at the border, that work is really at the border between musicology and the history of science. My interest in salons really emerged from that project on Sarah Levy, as I mentioned before. I had the great good fortune to meet a colleague here at Rutgers, Nancy Sinkhoff, whom I met her when I first arrived in 2012, and mentioned to her that I was sort of interested in pursuing this figure, Sarah Levy, and maybe giving a little concert of music that came from her collection. And Nancy was wonderful in saying, no, we should not. You shouldn't just stop at a concert. We should really make a big deal out of this woman, who was very little understood, I think. You know, there had been some work done on her by scholars of the Bach tradition, because she was a sort of important link in transmitting mm-hmm. Bach's music to her her great nephew Felix Mendelssohn. But at the same time, you know, thinking about how this music functioned in her world, in her life, placing her at the center of the story, and thinking about the way that she intersected with you know, Jewish culture and musical culture and Enlightenment culture, and how her subjectivity as a woman and as a Jewish person sort of influenced the way that she functioned in the world. That was a position that we felt we could take that was quite new. So that's an edited volume. It's a collection of essays by musicologists and scholars of Jewish studies, history and philosophy, sort of thinking about you know, what it looks like to place Sarah Levy at the center of that story. So that in turn served as a springboard for thinking about some of these other women who appear in this new book. Sarah Levy is one of them. There's a chapter devoted to her in this book. But in addition, I'm trying to place her alongside and on equal footing with other salon hostesses who had really special musical interests, including Madame Brion, but also Mariana Martinez, who was a saloniere in Vienna. Even the painter Angelica Kaufmann, or Angelica Kaufmann, who spent a lot of her career in London, but then when she returned to Rome in the 1780s, she started hosting a salon there that featured music very prominently, and she was herself a very musical person. And also the Philadelphia salon hostess, Elizabeth Graham, who in the 1760s hosted a salon where music was apparently featured again prominently. She owned a harpsichord. She sort of traveled in very musical circles, and we have evidence from her, some of her manuscripts that have been not really fully explored in the past, of her interest in music. So, you know, the beginning of the book sort of thinks about salons across, musical salons across Europe and America, between about 1760 and 1800. And it raises a whole cast of characters, whom I really enjoyed getting to know and sort of starting to think about, from a figure like Anne Ford in England in the 1760s, you know, through the Countess Duchess of Osuna y Benavente in Madrid, who, again, her family also was very musical, and she amassed a huge collection of music. So there are really these, you know, figures still, I think, very much shrouded in mystery and are, you know, waiting to be explored and discovered. So I do a little exposition of the issues related to musical salons, including the gendered subjectivity of the salon hostess, the way that the salon functioned as a site of women's education, the way that it allowed women to exercise agency and influence their cultural environments. And then the second chapter is about some of those performance practices that were used in salons. And then chapters 3 through 7 are sort of close readings of salons hosted by those 5 women whom I mentioned mm-hmm. previously.
So I think let's talk right off the bat about salons, right, in sure. general. And I think that most of our listeners, me included, I'm familiar with this concept, but I always think of them as space for conversation, as these very kind of unenjoyable, that's probably a bit much, but just very like dry intellectual conversation spaces. And you paint a very different portrait of a salon, like a musical salon. Right. So can you tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah. So I think that they were not really dry spaces. I think that you know, it, sometimes we think of them that way, maybe because we think of them as sort of cultivating a very stilted kind of conversation or mm-hmm. mannered kind of yeah. conversation. But that's, I think that that's not how they were seen at the time. Mm-hmm. So a salon was actually, the term itself was used in the 18th century predominantly to describe a room, right, a parlor or a salon. And we've come to apply this later terminology of the salon, which was really applied this way in the 19th century, backwards onto the 18th century. But in the 18th century, these gatherings that took place in the salon would have been called an assembly or a conversazione or a rout or a roulade, or right, there's any number of terms that were used to describe them. But they were essentially a regular, often weekly gathering of a very diverse range of people, starting, you know, in the second half of the 18th century. They could be hosted, they were most often hosted by an upper class woman, someone who had the financial means to welcome guests into her home so regularly, often feeding them, among other things, right? So there's sort of financial expectations associated with that. But at the same time, this was also the age when professional musicians, again, very often women, could start hosting salons and imitating that upper class behavior because their education or their, you know, polite manners could stand instead of aristocratic birth. And so they could also function as salon hostesses starting in this period. So, you know, the hostess would welcome into her home friends and acquaintances, professional class artists and musicians, and you know, philosophers or intellectuals, mm-hmm. scientists, as well as other members of the upper class, the aristocracy. So there is a kind of mix of social class and sort of place in society mm-hmm. that's happening in these salons. And there's a mixture of, you know, kind of mixing of values and norms also happening. And so, you know, the salon hostess would be responsible for kind of setting the agenda of these gatherings and coordinating or governing, right, to use the term of historian Dina Goodman, governing the proceedings of the salon. So if the salon hostess had a strong interest in music and had, you know, instruments, for example, in her home, or had the means to pay for professional musicians to come and play either by themselves or with her in her home, then music could become an important part of the salon proceedings. So, for example, we know, you know, that when the Mozart family traveled across Europe when Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was quite young, you know, his father ensured that they stopped at some of the most fashionable salons in Paris, for example, mm-hmm. where Madame Geoffrin, one of the leading salon hostesses of the day, welcomed the family. Now, Madame Geoffrin herself did not have a strong background in music, but she was still an arbiter of taste. And she would later help the Mozart family kind of get established. But then simultaneously, you have women like Madame Brion, who were very musical and who hosted in her salon the same kind of mix of artists and intellectuals and professionals and amateurs and everybody kind of gathering together. So, for example, we know that Benjamin Franklin spent a lot of time in her salon when he was her neighbor in Paris between 1777 and 85, right? He was there as ambassador of the newly formed United States. Mm-hmm. But he was very interested in music. We know he enjoyed music, especially if you think about his invention of the glass harmonica, or sort of reconfiguration of the glass harmonica, which became a very widely popular instrument. But he did not like going to the public opera or the concert hall. So he described Madame Brion's home as his opera. I call this my opera, for I hate going to the opera at Paris. And he would go there. He describes being entertained by Madame Brion and her daughters, and also by the professional violinist, Noel Pagin, who used to hang out there. And he would have a dish of tea and a game of chess and some music. And so the environment could be very, for all of the stilted conversation and mannered mm-hmm. conversation, the environment could still be very relaxed. You know, I think that the fact that Benjamin Franklin gave Madame Brion a glass harmonica, and he actually described playing it with her in heaven, right? One day they would both be dead and in heaven, and he would play the glass harmonica with her. That actually shows that that spirit of kind of mixing of, you know, very experienced mm-hmm. musicians with very inexperienced musicians, that was something that probably happened in her home as well. So
this, the salon as you describe it, though, this space really makes us kind of expand our ideas about what the Enlightenment looked like, mm. right? What the intellectual milieu of this period is. It's not someone talking about Enlightenment philosophers alone, right? It's this space for enjoyment and interaction. And it's a much more dynamic Enlightenment that you describe.
So I think that one of the key aspects of Enlightenment thought is the idea of sympathy, the idea that through sociability, through interaction with other people, we gain a better understanding of their perspectives. We learn to put ourselves in another person's shoes. So this, for example, is a theory that's espoused by Adam Smith, by David Hume, and they actually write about this new phenomenon where people of both sexes are mixing with each other and conversing and meeting in comfort and in leisure and in this very sociable way. And this helps to advance the cause of sympathy, that it can actually make us understand other people better. And this is something that that could not really take place in academies, for example, in these more homogeneous environments. The heterogeneous, heterosocial environment where women and men of different social standings and different backgrounds could mix was actually, I think, a key to enacting this Enlightenment value of sympathy. So that's something that Salonière, that women specifically, mm-hmm. could bring to the table, to the project of Enlightenment, that was really not possible in the men-only environment of the philosophical academy.
Right.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I get this. So you've written, as you mentioned, you write about these a few women in particular, and each of them explores a theme, right? And so we've talked a good deal about Madame Brion. Let's go on with her. So how does she and her salon lead you to an exploration of authorship?
Sure. Yeah, she's a fascinating case. Yes, she was an author. She wrote extensively, and she was a composer of music. She composed extensively, but she never published her work, and never sought to publish her work. So I think there's been this understanding of Madame Brion in the past that, you know, she was a kind of not very talented amateur, both in writing and in musical composition. And I think that that requires some reassessment, which is one of the things that I try to do in the book. The fact that she never published her writings or her music reflects her understanding of herself as an upper class woman who had to kind of adhere to social norms of privacy. Even of what I'm calling a poetics of the ephemeral. So even though she's writing down certain aspects of her work and her musical compositions, she is not intending these things to be kind of judged after the fact and held up against, you know, models of composition that would enter the public sphere in a kind of more a more concrete or fixed way. She's not looking to subject herself to public scrutiny like that. What she's looking for is music as a vehicle of sociability. Excuse me. So her music does just that. It's beautiful sounds, right? It's filled with evidence of herself performing with her daughters and her friends. And I think when we meet the music on those terms and sort of appreciate the way that she meanders in these beautiful sounds, especially with that wonderful square piano that I was talking about earlier, you know, we can come to a new kind of understanding of what her compositional approach would have been. Now, at the same time, that does not mean that she didn't influence the public sphere. Mm-hmm. So there were many composers and really kind of prominent, significant composers who dedicated music to her. And in their letters of dedication, they actually write, not just kind of in very broad formulaic terms, but specifically about being in her salon. And one composer, the very famous cellist and predominantly string composer, Luigi Boccherini dedicated his Opus 5 set of sonatas for violin and keyboard to Madame Brion. Now, as I mentioned, Boccherini is a cellist, and he writes in the letter of dedication to her, "I have never before written for the keyboard, and then I heard you. And then I learned how to write for the keyboard," right? So he is crafting these. I think he's not only crafting these pieces with her in mind, but I can imagine, I think it doesn't take too much of a kind of stretch of the imagination to envision him bringing these pieces to her salon and having her sight read them and play through them with him and say, you know what, this doesn't really work, or wow, you should really try this thing because listen to what the instrument can do if you do X, Y, or Z, right? And him saying, oh, now I get it, right? So I think that the salon could, in those kinds of cases, become a site of collaborative authorship. Mm-hmm. So she's not just the patron who sits aloof and, you know, kind of receives a gift of music in a passive way, or mm-hmm. even someone who provides just financial support, which I imagine that she did, in order to underwrite the cost of publication. But more than that, she's becoming someone whose musical values mm-hmm. and whose even her keyboard technique come to infuse these pieces by Boccherini, which then get published and circulate all over Europe and America. So she's entering the public sphere via the salon.
Sure. And instead of this supporting role as the salonnière, as someone who provides the space for male genius to play out, we right. see someone who's actively engaged in forming what will later be taken as male genius.
Yes. Right. Yes. Absolutely. And, you know, I think that even that notion of genius is such an anachronistic idea when we think about, you know, the 18th century. Yes, of course, there are lots of debates going on in this period about what genius looks like. But our understanding, especially in music, is so heavily shaped by the reception of Beethoven, Mozart, mm-hmm. Haydn, as, you know, these kind of geniuses of the 18th century, when again, in their lifetimes, Haydn and Mozart frequented salons, right? They found the salon to be an important platform for their professional agency, right? And the furthering of their careers. So they're interacting with women. I mean, Mozart had many, many female patrons and female students. And he wrote for them and he played with them. We know, for example, that in the 1780s in Vienna, he frequented the salon of another of the salonnière whom I write about, Mariana Martinez, and they played keyboard duets together, right? They sat down at the keyboard together and played forehands. And that was an important salon practice that's based in, like, well, we have one keyboard instrument here. And we have two keyboardists, and this is all about sociability and conversation, so let's have a conversation at the instrument. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, Madame Brion also wrote not only keyboard duets, but also keyboard trios. She had in her salon an English piano, a German piano, and a French harpsichord. And she was her and her two daughters, so they would sometimes play trios together. The trios are very kind of simple, clearly didactic pieces, they need to be understood in that way. But this is clearly an important performance practice that's part of the lives of a number of salonnières. That's also because women were so heavily associated with the keyboard above all, mm-hmm. right? They played keyboards, they played harp, they would sing. But for many women, the idea of playing a flute or a violin was sort of off limits by just social convention. It was unusual for women to play, not to say that they didn't, but it was more common for them to play keyboards and harps and to sing.
Okay, that I did not know, and I have to rethink this world, right? And I'm rethinking, like, you also mentioned ephemera, and I'm rethinking too, like, this idea that a lot of what happened in these spaces has disappeared forever. Yeah. We'll never know, but we will. You do, right? We do. We can see it.
Well, we can try, right? We can try to reconstruct and to deal with the sources on their own terms, mm-hmm. I think is a very important thing. So just once more on Madame Brion, her manuscripts were acquired by the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia in the 1950s. And they've been looked at a few times. And, you know, there have been a handful of concerts where that sort of try to reconstruct and revive some of that music. But otherwise, they just have not been taken seriously. Mm-hmm. They've really sort of lain almost untouched just for decades. And I think that speaks to you know, the kind of values of past generations, not just that she's a woman composer and therefore nobody wants to engage with her music, but that we have to be able to meet this music on its own terms and not sort of judge it against a Beethoven symphony. It's a very, very different kind of musical utterance. At the same time, I will say that there are loads of really interesting compositions by Mariana Martinez that do involve a full orchestra, you know, these wonderful concert arias that require very advanced vocal technique that are almost also completely unknown, just untouched. And it's very hard for me to wrap my head around why that might be. But it was a lot of fun for me to be able to work with those sources and think about how they sound and what they mean.
So let's move on to Mariana Martinez. What is it like you use her, I think the title, I don't have it right in front of me, but something Mariana Martinez and the Cultivation of Skill.
Right.
What do you want her to tell us? What do we want?
So again, just another fascinating, fascinating case. So Mariana Martinez, her family history is really interesting. Her connection to professional poets, musicians, composers, very interesting. And her kind of social trajectory is very interesting. So, you know, in contrast to Madame Brillon, who I think had to kind of adopt this aesthetic of ease, aesthetic of like effortlessness, and therefore wasn't engaging with really, really complex musical composition, Mariana Martinez did sort of, she trained very carefully. She studied with very serious composers in the Neapolitan operatic tradition, right? She was born in Vienna, but her family heritage is from Naples and even before then from Spain. So she's linking herself to the very popular Neapolitan idiom of opera and vocal music. In addition to that, though, her family was connected to one of the most important Italian poets of the 18th century, Pietro Metastasio, who was the most widely set librettist of opera librettos in the 18th century. Many, many composers set his librettos to music. The Martinez family actually shared an apartment with Metastasio in Vienna for decades. And it's not entirely clear what that was all about. It may have been that there was perhaps an intimate relationship between Metastasio and Mariana's father. But whatever the case, you know, she was really mentored by him. Mm-hmm. She almost became, you know, I think other people have looked at her and said, well, she's just being kind of subjected to, she's almost like an avatar for Metastasio. She never sort of gets her own agency or is never credited with having her own agency. And I think actually that that's not correct. I think that that they developed a very carefully crafted and productive collaborative relationship where he was able to kind of guide her education and sort of help her cultivate her social standing so that even though she was a composer and was widely known as a composer, she was very careful not to publish too much and not to publish very difficult or complex music, and instead to use the salon or this liminal space between public and private in her home to present herself musically. And that meant both to converse about music with visitors and dignitaries and to host other people playing music and to perform herself in her salon. Mm-hmm. So while other women composers in her orbit were actually, you know, they were sort of publicly derided and chastised, and there was a lot of outrage about the fact that they were putting themselves out there in public, Mariana Martinez basically avoided those kinds of, you know, the those kinds of judgments because she used the salon very strategically. Mm-hmm. And she and Metastasio were very careful about crafting her persona as one that wouldn't be too much out there in the public, but that still kind of benefited both of them.
This is a theme we keep coming back to, right? The idea of we define the Enlightenment as something that only meant to. We define the salons as places where these happen. Moderns are defining a world that they can understand, but where we're seeing instead these liminal spaces where the actors involved are creating a world they can make sense of, right? Or creating a space for their own expression.
Exactly. Right?
Where they can collect, where they can create, where they can collaborate, like in a space that's just really, that is a nicer way to think about it, right? That is, I prefer this history. I prefer an idea where we're seeing women in particular able to exercise their agency. Yeah. And it really does, I know I've already said this, but it really does make us rethink kind of our ideas about enlightenment.
That would be great to help people kind of rethink these things. Mm-hmm. I also have to say that, you know, I think I'm consciously and proudly taking a feminist approach here, right? And when I say that, I mean, not that I'm coming in with an agenda of my own, although, you know, all scholars come in with our own baggage. Mm-hmm. But what I'm trying to understand is both what the limitations were on these women that were imposed from, you know, outside forces, about which I could say a little bit more in a moment, and also how they worked around those limitations to still be expressive and independent and exercise agency. That's the kind of tension that really fascinates me. So the case of the Salon of Angelica Kaufmann in Rome is one that I think sort of displays this really in an interesting way. So in the chapter on Kaufmann, I'm writing not only about her, but about these women improvisers who appeared and performed in her salon in Rome. So they were poets and singers and musicians who were these poetic improvisers who had to be able to extemporize on any subject. Like Angelica Kaufmann, these other women, and I'm including especially Teresa Bandettini and Fortunata Fantastici, these two women whom Angelica Kaufmann painted. She painted beautiful portraits of them in the 1790s and really seems to have shared a friendship with them. All three of them were basically unable to get formal training in their art. Like all women, they were excluded from going to school, mm-hmm. right? Which is, you know, I think today still something we really need to grapple with. How did these women... How did Angelica Kaufmann become a history painter of all things, which requires, you know, knowledge of languages and history and, you know, philosophy and sort of all sorts of fields that she would have had to self-educate in, as well as, right, for most history painters, they had to be able to study the male figure in the nude, which she was not allowed to do. Right. And then for the same is true of these two women improvisers, Bandettini and Fantastici, who had to be able to improvise on literally any subject. And there are long lists of these subjects that are outlined in descriptions of what they and other women improvisers did. They had to learn theology and history and philosophy and the sciences, all the sciences. They had to sort of, you know, be in command of, you know, vast quantities, thousands of years of literature, so that they would be able to refer to that literature in their improvisations. And they had to do it all while playing the violin or singing. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Right? Like,
right.
You know, dancing backwards in heels, right?
That kind of like, you know, backwards in heels.
So the strategy that all three women used, which I think was widespread, is that they cast themselves as muses.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
They had to get an education. They had to work hard, but in order to avoid being considered kind of freaks of nature or being attacked. Mm-hmm. For being overly, you know, audacious in attaining an education, they portrayed themselves as channeling the ancient muses, which allowed them, it sort of gave them the cover that they needed. You know, they're not these modern working women who are doing it all. They're actually, you know, channeling Sappho. They're like the modern oracles of Sappho, and descriptions of the performances of these women improvisers, you know, it was very much like a kind of dramatic embodiment of these ancient muses. They would act as if they're almost in a trance, and they would invoke the great name of God or of the ancient muse, and they would start slowly and then work them up into a kind of work themselves up into a kind of frenzy where they're singing and improvising, and their audiences are astounded. And all of this happens in the context of the salon because they have to be able to interact with their audience. Right, the whole art of improvisation depends upon one of the audience members or one of the visitors to the salon proposing a topic and saying, can you improvise on the history of X? And they have to be able to do it. So that sociability is actually key to what they're doing. But I think that, you know, just looking at some of the literature on the way that that muse trope, the trope of the woman artist as muse, has been understood in the last 30 years, let's say, a lot of people say, well, that's just men. The men were imposing that trope on those women. No, no. In many cases, the women themselves are adopting the trope of the muse because it gave them the excuse that they needed to appear educated.
Right. It gives them a legitimate way to exercise power.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
This is delightful. What a great talk, great book. And I've taken up enough of your time already. And so I just really want to wrap this up. I have just one more question. So what are you working on now? What's next? something next, right?
Well, one really nice thing that's coming out of this project is that I'm working with another colleague, Jackie Avila from the University of Tennessee, to edit a new history of women and musical salons from the late 16th century through the present. So that is a project that's in the works. We're really excited that book is under contract with Cambridge University Press and will be out. It won't be out anytime soon because the chapters haven't been written yet, but we're really excited to see that take shape. And for myself, I've actually been spending some time working on music and letters, really, of the Black British writer and composer Ignatius Sancho, who was apparently the first Black person to publish his original musical compositions. So I've been writing, you know, some articles on Sancho and his music, and also leading an interdisciplinary research group here at Rutgers that is thinking about the arts in the worldview of and the worldview and practice of Ignatius Sancho. So that's what I'm up to these days.
That is fantastic. That sounds very good. I love the space you've made for yourself that you get to play with these really neat ideas and kind of you get to unearth and bring out, you know, these people who have been ignored. So just pretty good work. Like, good job. Good work if you can get it, right? That's great. I also, once again, listeners, remember that this is not just a book. You also get music with this, right? How is that accessible to our listeners? When they purchase your book, they can go to a website?
Well, the website is actually linked for free. There's no need to purchase the book in order to hear the audio examples. Although, of course, we hope that you'll read the book from the University of Chicago Press. So if you can find the book on the University of Chicago Press website, there's a link to the website that has all the audio examples.
And it's something you haven't heard before. This will be a new and exciting soundscape for you. So our listeners, so wonderful. All right, Rebecca, thank you so much for taking some time with me today to talk about your book. It's really enjoyable. Thanks so much for writing it. And it seems like you probably had a good time with it.
I had a great time, and it's been a pleasure to speak with you about it. Thank you.